theory, kind of atomic theory of associations between sign and signified, and the constitutive theories, which is what kind of we've been talking about in reference to Wittgenstein and media theory, where language is seen as constitutive or immanent within the world and of the things that it's used for and specifically done with. I bring up Condillac because Herder is introduced to talk about the criticisms that the constitutive or that the HHH theory or HHH school is going to make of inframing theory, right? They have their own constitutive theory, but their criticisms are of the inframing theory. In any case, Herder's representing the HHH school at this point. Herder is going to take a kind of stab at Condillac, whose position is actually a little bit different than Hobbes and Locke. So Hobbes and Locke's position is very much rudimentary in that sense of like, we have, you know, there's an objective world and we use language to represent and correspond and to represent that. And truth is correspondence between the objective world and the propositions used to describe that world, right? Condillac is going to say specifically that language is, so he actually has like a kind of proto-behaviorist theory of language where we really do just at first make sounds and noises. We're pre-reflective about our language use. It comes out of our an initial form of life. So we make cries when we're hurt or upset. We yell when we're angry. We feel certain ways when we're hungry and we might express those in certain ways. But what language lets us do is, he says specifically, it affords us dominion over our imagination. Now, by imagination, he means kind of the collection, the bundle of associations that we collect over our experiences, right? So our imagination is necessarily conditioned by the reflexes that we kind of pick up as we go through life. But language lets us pick out certain reflexes and do certain things with it, right? So instead of just being at the whims of my reflexes, of my instinctual calls and whatnot, language actually allows me to control my particular calls. So instead of just yelling when I'm angry, I can use that call. And for Condillac, this is where like a language starts. It has this natural basis. And then language gives us the power to control those things, right? So now I'm not just using, now I'm not just screaming in pain when I stub my toe or something like that. Or I'm not just complaining in hunger when I'm hungry. I can now use these differently. So for example, say if I miss someone, I can, using language, say pull from the repository of associations that I have and use the pang of hunger to express my missing someone or something like it, to this effect. Essentially, Condillac's theory is one, I'm a little bit impressed by it because he really is trying to, he has found an initial body of natural associations, and then he wants to say that we build up all kinds of different, more complicated reactions based on this, right?
You know, like listening to this, and I might be a little bit off base, but like my head immediately goes to like trying to picture what Condillac is doing or trying to represent, you know, with the, the kind of atomic view of language or the sign and signified. You know, I think back to like, okay, well, what sort of move or what is Condillac trying to point out that's important? Well, I think about like, you know, kind of Neolithic culture or like the very early origins of language as being like a primary aspect of like human community, right? And like, in some sense, sign and signified makes like a lot of sense in that world, right? Like you point at, you know, we communicate mammoth and we communicate like attack or ownership or whatever it might be, or like web spear or arrow or et cetera, et cetera. But then I start thinking about, like, there was a point in like the Neolithic era where we start to do artistic representation, right? Like you start to get cave paintings and, you know, there's the famous handprints, and there's, you know, you know, representations that are clearly more like symbolic than like representative of some sort of like instance or whatever, right? Like actual artistic endeavor. And it seems like Condillac is trying to point out that, like, there gets to a point where maybe like the you know, the truth as correspondence and the aspect of sign and signified at its most like basic interpretation has a hard time communicating or representing more abstract and ethereal concepts like, you know, community or like spiritual understandings or like religious understanding, whatever, which is then, you know, and obviously it's like cave paintings are in some sense a form of language. They're obviously not vocally linguistic, but it's clearly a kind of communication that's more than just like super primary survival mode activity based language.
Yeah. That's the interesting thing about those is it's like, I think, when we think about art, and I think it's correct to call those things art, we tend to think of it's like, I'm going to butcher the term, but how superfluous it is, how it's a surplus built on top of what is not necessary for survival. I think that the emphasis on something like survival is a little, you know, it might be like theoretically conservative and stuff like that. It might make for really tidy theories, but it obviously doesn't capture the phenomena that we want to talk about. It just is more head scratching about what art could possibly be. But in any case, there is something that, so I'll just read from Taylor. What's new is that now the mind is in control. Thus, the cry of fear can be used to communicate the presence of danger to another as a voluntary and not just a reflex action. And as a way of designating danger, it can be used in reasoning about the antecedents and consequences of certain forms of threat. So there really is some kind of, you know, with the hand paintings, there is some kind of emergence of a different kind of awareness about the initial, you know, if there was like an initial reflex reaction that we had, there's something more built on top of and going on with these higher form, to use like metaphorical language, the higher forms of control of language. And Condillac wants to say that this is that language is the origin of this, that mind is there, and then it can start to work with these things. Now, that's what places Condillac, though, in the enframing theory, is that language is what lets us do that, right? So we have this capacity, language, and we have these associations, and we can start controlling them. Now, Charles Taylor calls this a just-so story, right? And he refers to a story that Condillac actually uses, which is children on a desert island, which is like a very typical kind of like way of isolating people, you know, yeah, kind of thing. That, you know, Condillac wants to have he has this kind of thought experiment where if you put kids on a desert island, eventually they'll, you know, language will, they'll be doing more things with their reflex actions as we've been describing. But this is where Herder comes in, because he has a critique of this specifically, which is that it kind of presupposes the very thing that it's trying to explain or theorize or, you know, explain the emergence of. So for if it's the case for Condillac that language is what gives us, as he says, dominion over our imagination, what allows us to take these reflex actions and do different things with them, that kind of presupposes the very capacity to do that, right? Like, where does that capacity come from?
Condillac may take the HLC theory like to its limits, it's still ultimately sees language as, you know, entrapped or, and as you would say, enframed in like the human psyche as a some kind of technology in that, in, you know, in that, in human operation.
Yeah, exactly. It is something for us to use to control, you know, at this point it is the, again, yes, dominion over our imagination, but then it kind of expands outward in this very kind of, you know, Cartesian way from, it starts with us, we can control ourselves, and then we can communicate with each other, so we can start controlling each other, and then through our collaboration through language, we can start controlling our environment and whatnot. So it's very much so an instrumentalized conception of language, where language is a technology or a tool for having dominion over the world, essentially. And I mean, language does give us that capacity. But there are other theories for the role, or at least the relationship between the language and the world, right? Which the constitutive theory is going to take an antithetical relationship to, right? I mean, Charles Taylor specifically says it's the antitype of it. So in the text, he doesn't say that Herder's relation or Herder's theory is like a reversal, but I do detect a certain kind of reversal in Herder's critique of Condillac, because what Condillac is doing is presupposing that there is this capacity we have, language, which then gives us the capacity to control certain associations. Herder wants to say that's a presupposition. Really, what we should be doing is looking to see how that capacity emerges out of our language use instead, right? So it's not that we have, you know, capacities like the capacity to cry out in pain, or we have these basic emotional responses, and then we have language that can control them and use them deliberately in certain ways, you know, with antecedents for consequences and whatnot. Specifically, Herder is going to say that the use of language gives us the capacity for reflexiveness. Specifically, it's out of that reflexiveness for our use of these things that we'll be able to not just control them, but even like make new ones. Herder starts from the intuition that language makes possible a different kind of consciousness. So if the very thing that Condillac is presupposing is some kind of consciousness or mind that has the capacity to use language, Herder is seeing how that consciousness emerges out of language use, right? So it's that reversal that I'm saying that Taylor doesn't necessarily say is there, but by saying that the constitutive theory is the antitype of the enframing theory, I think he's saying that he reverses the relationship between consciousness and language in Herder to try and fill in a gap that Herder sees in Condillac's theory. I'll continue. So Herder starts from the intuition that language makes possible a different kind of consciousness, which he calls reflective, Bissonen. And interestingly, just a thing about the text, I should say, anytime that there's a translation from either German or French or Latin, Charles Taylor always includes the original text, which I think is kind of neat. Yeah, which he calls reflective, and then in German, Bissonen. That is why he finds a continuity explanation like Condillac so frustrating and unsatisfying. The issue of what this new consciousness consists in and how it arises is not addressed, as far as Herder is concerned, by an account in terms of pre-existing elements. That's why he accuses Condillac of begging the question. Quote, the abbot Condillac has already presupposed the whole of language as invented before the first page of his book. What did Herder mean by reflection, Bissonenheit? This is harder to explain. I have tried to reconstruction in The Importance of Herder, which is an article that Charles Taylor wrote. We might try to formulate it this way. Pre-linguistic beings can react to the things which surround them, but language enables us to grasp something as what it is. This explanation is hardly transparent, but it puts us on the right track. To get a clear idea, we need to reflect on what is involved in using language. And then he goes on to talk about, he gives an example of, you know, the classic example of talking about a triangle and what we mean by that.
Pre-linguistic being goes around interacting and reacting with things, but, you know, a linguistic being interacts with things like as what they are or as what it is. in the sense of like, there is, you know, we've talked about this in relationship with, you know, phenomenologists and stuff that we've discussed on the show many times, where, you know, there's nothing that's not, like, there's nothing that is unlike anything else. And everything kind of like has a place, and the world is like a I don't want to say orderly, but it's a reliably meaningful structure that like we inhabit and are a part of and don't necessarily impose ourselves on.
Specifically, I think by that, what you're saying is that the context within which we find ourselves, they almost kind of nudge the way that we use the words into fitting into that context correctly. The rest of this section, I should say, is kind of dedicated to what seem like really obtuse examples of like rats running through doors with triangles on them and talking about the possibility of monkeys using sign language. And this is kind of point up the Kondalakian idea of the relationship between language and its associations. The problem with that is that if language is just reflexive, then language is not necessarily concerned with, as you said, and I think you pointed out, these are the key terms, with what's really going on or with what something is. It's just concerned with reactions to a particular environment. Whereas when we're trying to use language, we're actually kind of concerned with certain truth conditions about the correctness or the incorrect use of our language, right? We have a capacity to assess whether our language use is proper or improper, correct or incorrect, and we know when our language falls short and when it doesn't, right?
Well, and to use like a kind of an odd example that pops into my head, like, you know, if you had like a map or something like that, that, you know, showed every sort of truthless correspondence or every sort of sign to signify in the language form, you know, if theoretically, if that's all that language was, you could, in a sense, like move all the words, you know, if you had every sort of word next to a picture of what it is, you could, in theory, you know, just like nudge the, you know, one slider over and change the signifier for every single word. But obviously that's not how language actually works, right? Like we can't just like, you know, cup can't suddenly become book and book can't suddenly become lemon, you know what I mean? Like that the signification just isn't there like that.
Yeah, no. And so, yeah, this is kind of the interesting thing, too, though, is that there is something kind of arbitrary about language in that, like, if we want to call something some, like, random particular thing, right, we could do that. But the important thing is that that is the very definite meaning of an arbitrary sign is constituted by the activity of agreeing on that, right? And it's that is what is the like contextual framework within which that activity makes sense, right? And that's why you couldn't just like, as you were saying, like, this is a really great example, I actually like it, you couldn't just like bump the words in the dictionary over a little bit and then everything would make sense, as if everything is just like an arbitrary sign and we would just know what everyone meant. That's not true. And that also like kind of ignores like interword meanings as well. There really is like a meaning to the pre in something like pre-critical or pre-reflective or something like that. So we really do like have those kind of cues. It's not as if, and the other thing too is it's not like if pre gets bumped over, then you can preface or you can like prefix cat as anything because of the grammar doesn't make sense.
It's a linguistic world that like that we inhabit and that we sort of swim through, and it's all contextual, but it's also all shared. And I think that's like the big thing as well, right? Like that it's all, again, like you said, like you could like in theory be completely arbitrary with your language. At a certain point, then that just becomes a private language, which is no language at all.
Yeah, it's not even, yeah, we could do a whole episode on private language. I mean, that's it's a huge thing. But the important thing that we're talking about here is in the contrast between, again, we don't have the constitutive theory necessarily on the table just yet. We do have Herder's critiques of Condillac's theory, which do start to form the constitutive theory, which is that the language and its meaning are immanent in the activities and its use and its relationship to the world. Condillac has something that seems like that by saying that our natural inclinations can then be made conscious and we can control them. But what Herder wants to actually say is that, okay, well, if what we're actually trying to do is explain the origins of language, you've just presupposed language as control over your associations. So where does that consciousness come from, right? And Herder wants to say that consciousness of being able to control those associations comes from the fact that we can use words rightly and wrongly. Charles Taylor specifically coins the term, and I guess I think this is because maybe Herder didn't have this. He didn't make this explicit, or he didn't come up with this term himself. And Charles Taylor is kind of like trying to flesh out what Herder is doing. But Charles Taylor says that this is a concern of what he calls intrinsic rightness, right? That when we use words, even if maybe what they are arbitrary or anything like that, we're aiming towards a kind of asymptotic limit of truth, to use a term Zwicky would say. Like, truth is an asymptotic limit of our responsibility towards the world, right? That when we use language, we're actually aiming to use it correctly or incorrectly, sensibly or nonsensically, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's actually played out, like, in some sense, like, if we're taking, like, again, going back to the history of language, it's like, okay, well, with the HLC model, there's a problem, you know, that Condillac still kind of had, where it's sort of like, it's almost like it's sort of like big bang booms onto the scene. But you have like it's almost like the constitutive theory makes more sense within like the anthropology of something like etymology, where you see like obvious, you can see the history and anthropology of language as a clearly historical, like active growing process that's like constantly shifting and changing and absorbing new languages or pushing new things out as the world that is actually being inhabited itself is changing with that.
That's actually a really, really good point I hadn't thought about, that in the difference between the inframing theory and the constitutive theory, or at least between the schools of the HLC and the HHH, the HLCs kind of see language as like this given phenomena. And the question is, okay, well, how did it emerge? Again, like, this is a really good picture. It's like a big bang, right? Well, we have language. Okay, well, how did that happen? Whereas the HHH school sees language not as like, oh, maybe it has a kind of like big bang moment, but the thing about the Big Bang even now is like things are still kind of expanding. The Big Bang is still happening, more or less. Language is still in development. Language does change. And this is a theory of language that is more conducive to seeing actual real-time change. You know, really good example that you brought up too, with etymology, right? Like the quote-unquote true meaning of words, where meanings of words are not just like our essential associations being changed or us having like defining things in atomic or correspondent ways, but like actually the way that we use these words and the way that the words have like relationships to their use in the past, and the way that our reflective use and concern for us using those terms properly gets changed with the evolving circumstances within which we use language.
Yeah, I mean, like think about, like, as we end the show, it's like there's it seems like, as we kind of think about it, like, such an, how it is the HHH model is so much more conducive to that. Like, you think about a kind of like the sort of like Creole, or like, you know, like during, you know, the transference of slaves and colonization of like the southern United States, where you have this sort of like linguistic world that is reflective not only of like bringing over more ancient African terms, but interplaying that with, you know, European language, and then also to how those languages are also reflective of kind of a hierarchies within society, and you have like certain ways of speaking that are more reflective of like a kind of, you know, a slave culture, or like, you know, like, you know, a kind of like aristocratic class or blah, 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 and the interplay between all that kind of stuff. And again, that's all evolution and linguistic events that are actually like happening in the world, and the language is changing and shifting and evolving with that and moving it along at the same time, like as a is a part of that. It's not being like dragged along. It is that process in a sense.
Yeah. And I mean, to kind of, as we're kind of closing out, let's compare those two schools with this example, right? Which is like, with the HHH model, we have something that's more organic and tied to the way that we reflectively concern ourselves with the right or wrong use of these terms. And that kind of explains their specific evolution as not just like we have language and we can start using it, but we have these particular resources and our kind of linguistic consciousness emerges out of our capacity to use these. It's hard to imagine the situation going down like that if the HLC school is right? Because if we just have control over our, association
language model,
if we just have control over that, then there shouldn't be as much linguistic diversity or as much kind of like difference that we really do see. There shouldn't be as much change because the starting point is more or less the same.
You would expect a much higher degree of like rigidity within these, and instead what you're seeing is a whole mishmash of like cultural activity that's also like material, that's also like deeply material, that like creates whole new like language systems basically that are reflective of a whole, like, this is because this is also like a whole new world, like literally within like the context of the new world, but also, you know, within the context of relationships of, you know, European expansion and slavery and all the things that are like, this is all very new stuff, and in a sense like requires, creates, and like rides upon a new linguistic wave.
The beginning of this book is quite modest. It's more or less Charles Taylor setting out the stakes for what he sees as kind of the gold standard for the theories of language as they come up throughout the book, which is this idea of intrinsic rightness. But I think that's a good way of setting this, actually like putting value into these stakes, is that the HHH model is going to have way more capacity to be able to deal with real emergent kind of phenomena in language and the way that that language is embedded in our world. Whereas there's something a bit empty or deflated about the HLC model in that it really can't account for something like that. Or if it does, it's not really concerned with, again, like the gold standard for Taylor, at least from what I've gathered initially, this intrinsic rightness, that it's more or less just associations, and if it's just associations, then it doesn't really bear any relationship to the world as it's emerging. These are just the introductory kind of chapters to this book, but it gets me kind of excited to continue reading, because I also do kind of know that it's going to go a lot further than this. It's going to talk a lot about the way that identity emerges out of our the way that stories and narratives shape the way that identities emerge. There's like a short chapter where he discusses the Sipper Wharf hypothesis as well. So he's very concerned with setting down a really solid foundation for talking about just the phenomena that we're talking about, this kind of world, you know, to use Heideggerian terms, these world disclosing features of language.
You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show once again. I'm Hale, and with me has been Brandon, and we've been talking about Charles Taylor, a Canadian philosopher, which I think we should probably do more of. So hopefully Taylor and some other Canadians will be on again soon.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano, every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancora fanciulli e ogni sera su.